Grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 271 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. Chris Jordan, your host here, coming to you live from Austin, Texas tonight. Our guest, the amazing Professor Richard B. Spence, 30 years a professor at Ohio State University. He is the instructor for the Great Courses series from the History Channel, available on Amazon Prime, also available on Audible. Real History of Secret Societies. Rick is absolutely amazing. I have been deep diving into this. I got his new book, or not new book, actually, but his book here, Secret Agent 666, about Aleister Crowley being in the intelligence industry, things like that. We're going to be talking about secret societies tonight. I cannot wait. We're going to be talking about Hellfire Club, Masons, early secret societies in America, and kind of demystifying them a little bit. Let's get into our guest real quick. First, here is a great clip. When I first saw this, this is what led me to search him out. I was like, I have to find him and have him on the show. I have not heard something like this since, like, straight up philosophy class at University of Dallas. It is beautiful. Check this out, folks. This is kind of our opening salvo into the show and what it's about. And you'll hear a lot of this echoed from past episodes of Dudes and Beer.
I call this course the real history of secret societies, and I should explain why. I don't mean the opposite of fake history. There's a common belief that history is a known quantity, that it's all recorded in a book just sitting there for us to absorb. That's dead wrong. The vast majority of human experience, everything that people have said and done, has been lost in time like tears in the rain. History is really an effort to reconstruct the past and the experience of it from the few facts that survive. That gives lots of room for interpretation and speculation. So most of what passes for history is actually opinion. Real history is incomplete, contradictory, and argumentative. In short, it's messy. A past seen through a glass darkly. And when you add secrecy to the mix, well, things really get messy. So in this course, I'm not always going to tell you just what's true and what isn't, because often it's just not clear. Instead of definite answers, there's often going to be a range of possibilities. Usually, I'm not setting out to defend or to debunk anything. That's because real history is like life, a permanent state of uncertainty. So we're going on a journey across centuries and continents in search of secret societies in all their variety. That will take us to some very dark places, and frankly, some silly ones. What I want you to listen and look for in these lectures is the repetition of names and, more importantly, ideas. The same things coming up again and again in slightly different name or form or context. I can't guarantee it will all make sense, but I guarantee it'll be interesting and enlightening. Get ready. Here we go.
And I was entirely ready for something totally different whenever I tuned into this. And when I heard that statement, I was like, my God, what a breath of fresh air. This is not going to be the typical thing. This is going to be an actual learned explanation of secret societies. Please welcome to the show, Professor Richard B. Spence. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great, Chris. It's great to be on.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you so much for taking the time, number one, to make this incredible series, The Real History of Secret Societies, available from Great Courses and the History Channel. What exactly brought you into this realm of study to begin with? Because you're a professor of history 30 plus years, correct?
Well, I got my PhD, I got my union card, you could say, in 1981. So that's when I eventually got out of college, and then I stayed in college to work there. How do you like that?
Yeah.
So every academic nerd's dream, that's what it is to basically just stay in college for the rest of your life and get paid for it. So
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I know quite a few people that aspired to that, a few people that have attained it. And it's a beautiful thing when literally your pursuit is just the passionate pursuit of knowledge. And like you said, in not just our pre-interview, but in that preamble to the course, The Real History of Secret Societies, that history really is an open-ended question. Like I said in the pre-interview, one of the things that we get into a lot on this show is the religion of science, the religion of history, the way that we're literally told something for forever, and we just tend to believe it without any self-exploration into the topic. And how many times does that lead to other things, wrong ways of thinking, skewed ways of thinking even?
Yeah, it's one of the things that, you know, in addition to the Great Courses History Channel class, or set of lectures, is derived from a course I actually teach at the University of Idaho, mm-hmm. which is called Conspiracies and Secret Societies in History. And it's kind of interesting that I propose that, I don't know, it was, you know, 20, 25 years ago probably was the first time I taught it. And I proposed it initially for what was called, they're sort of a special set of classes called honors classes. And those tend to be, you know, they're basically for overachievers, which is a good thing.
Yeah, they're people who literally tested out of four or five classes and have to take something to get the credits.
Basically, students who are bored with everything else they've taken and are looking for something different. And so I thought, well, you know, I'll propose this. And honestly, I didn't think it would go through. I thought someone would look at it. And
sure.
But no, it did. And then I had to figure out how to teach this course, and I've been doing that ever since. And it was, it's always been, you know, one of the main things that has probably kept me interested and engaged as a teacher and as an academic and as a researcher is that it's interesting to me. All right, you can't really, I think, meaningfully explain something that you're tired of or you're bored of. So I'm constantly learning new things. Collecting new secret societies is like collecting, you know, merit badges or, you know, beer caps or whatever it is. But there's just so many of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, at any point, and this is a thing I'd mention, at any point you think you know everything about something, you don't, all right? And that's and this is why I always kind of, you know, cringe a little bit if somebody calls me an expert on something. And because sometimes expert is used, it's sometimes used by people as a kind of club to beat it, you know, a kind of, you know, intellectual bullying. You know, I'm an expert and you're an ignoramus, all right? So you should believe everything that I say.
Well, and also the other way around, by people to go, hey, this is my expert, believe what I'm saying.
You know,
and then you're getting involved in a whole nother way. Oh yeah, by the way, everybody, this is my expert.
Yes, and you know, the expert word just tends to close off, and that's you know a lot. I mean, I know a lot about. I have an unhealthy level of knowledge in some cases about certain things.
Yeah.
But that's all I'll say, and that's never a term that I would ever use for myself. I would never introduce myself as an expert.
Yeah.
Because I would say, you know, I'm knowledgeable about these things. I'm never going to claim to you that I know everything, that there isn't something else that I could learn about it. I would never argue in most cases that I couldn't possibly be wrong about things. But I'll try not to be, all right? I'll try not to deliberately mislead you, which is what more than I can say than you always get in college, you know?
Yes, yes. And that's absolutely true. All too frequently you do see that issue where, and like we're saying, it's very much the a cabal in and of itself, very much almost a cult of personality that brings about this haughtiness of this is what I was taught. This is what's in these three books. So it must be right. I mean, for crying out loud, until what, like 1930 something, Troy was mythical. Troy did not exist. It was a myth. If you said that Troy existed, it was like, yeah, okay, dude, Atlantis too, bro. And lo and behold, the city of Troy is real. Been found, archaeological site, you can go visit it.
All Schliemann, the amateur archaeologist, not a professional one, but an amateur, who found it, all he did was to follow the breadcrumbs that were in Homer.
Yep.
And he found it. There it was. And all he did was something that no one prior to that, assuming, you know, well, I don't know, does Homer exist or he doesn't exist, so he must be making up this story and there couldn't have been this place. Well, nobody actually went and looked for it. And he did.
Yeah.
And there it was.
Well, and, you know, we have heard the same exact thing. We've had Graham Phillips on the show numerous times, and he's on the History Channel regularly, talking about Stonehenge. He's the gentleman who helped find the Mountain of Moses, the Staff of Moses, all kinds of stuff. And it, very much this is an echo of the same conversations we have had, where people are literally stuck in a modality of thought and do not consider the alternative, because it's the alternative. Why would you think that? And how was it that you first came to start researching secret societies and start coming into that realm? Because, I mean, of course, your first work as a history professor, things like that, were in the realm of Russian history, Russian military and espionage, things like that.
Well, you know, I've been asked this question a lot, and you'd think that I have a pat answer now that I could reel off. You know, how did you become interested in this, Professor Spence? And I don't, because I always, there isn't any particular reason for it. I mean, it probably has something to do with the fact that, yeah, you're just kind of attracted to certain things. And one of the things that's always kind of attracted me is if there's some sort of, you know, I like exploring unknown territory. I think that's it, you know?
Sure.
If I was going to be an explorer, I wouldn't want to go to the same places other people have been. I would want to try to find something new. And one of the things that I think that attracted me in history is anywhere I kind of ran across this blank spot.
Huh.
And so my real, you know, academic emphasis is in modern Russian history, and along with that, military espionage, Eastern Europe. You know, and you look at Russian history. Well, you know, you just landed in Conspiracy Central right there.
Yeah,
I mean, it is a very turbulent, fascinating, bloody, also very artful history that goes along. But if you study Russian history, even from the earliest times through Catherine the Great, certainly up through the Russian Revolution, well, one of the things that you're going to encounter, even though you may not be aware of it, is you're going to be encountering everything from Freemasons and endless political conspiracies and cabals of one kind or another. That's what makes the whole ball bounce.
Yeah.
So that's really, I'd say, what kind of introduced me to it. And the first book I wrote, which I think is almost unavailable now, is a thing called Renegade on the Left, which is a biography of a Russian political figure that I bet no one out there has ever heard of, and his name was Boris Savinkov. All right?
Okay.
And the reason you've never heard of him isn't because he didn't play any interesting historical role. It's because, to a great extent, he was just kind of written out of the history that came up later. So Savinkov was, you know, around during before and after 1917. So he's intimate. I've got to tell you his whole story. But he is as involved in the Russian revolutionary ferment of 1917 as much as Trotsky and Lenin were and any others. He's right there. He is on the scene. And at various points, he could have made critical decisions that might have changed history. So why isn't that we've ever heard about him? The simplest reason is that he's one of those guys who sort of burned every bridge he crossed and bit every hand that helped him. And that then made him, after his death, by mysterious means, by the way, in 1925, nobody liked him. I mean, he was one of those guys who would never sort of clearly fit into one political party or another. He was far too, he was much too much of a megalomaniac to do that. And he simply had become a kind of anathema to people. People who had befriended him no longer wanted to admit that they knew him. About the only people who would talk about him were the Bolsheviks, you know, the communists, because, you know, they eventually entrapped him and got him to confess his sins and then threw him out a window. But so he served the purpose for them as an example of the anti-communist villain. And but other than that, so what it was, back when I was a grad student, back in the 1970s, at UC Santa Barbara, I have to plug my old grad school.
Ooh.
At UC Santa Barbara, I was a history grad student, and you know, I was looking for something to write my dissertation on, and what I initially wanted to do for my dissertation was that book that I later wrote. I thought Savinkov was an interesting guy, because if you read the history of that era, he's popping up in all these places like a jack-in-the-box, but I can't really find very much about him. So I went to a professor, not my major professor, but a guy who was, you know, on my committee, and he would sort of have to approve this, and I said, look, I'm really interested in working on this guy, Savinkov, because I think there's a bigger story there. And he goes, nah, you don't want to waste your time doing that, okay? I mean, you don't want to waste your time doing it because, one, Savinkov is a loser, okay? He's an historical loser, and therefore you never want to pay attention to losers in history. Now, history is all about the winners, right?
Sure, sure.
So he's a loser, so don't pay any attention to him. And he goes, also, if he'd actually done anything really worth writing about, some other earlier, greater historian than you and I would already have written about him.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and because no one previously had paid, in other words, because like Troy, no one had gone looking for him, therefore he in a way didn't exist or wasn't important.
Sure.
You know, and being a student in that case, I was, you know, browbeaten enough to sort of drop that idea and go on to something else that wasn't half as interesting. So as soon as I could, you know, as soon as all of that was done, I went back to this topic that I had wanted to write about, and I did. And, you know, that's just kind of the stubborn person I am, I guess. But that showed you what my attraction to that was, and I really wanted to try to dig this guy out of the dustbin of history and at least, you know, kind of put his story out there.
Well, and that's just it. Like you said, dragging things out of the dustbin of history. Even in the earlier quote where you were saying that these things are lost like tears in the rain, they were there. Like you could not put it more poignantly. You can tell that you have been literally standing in front of classrooms for like 30 years, moving people with your words.
Well, the other thing you can tell by that phrase is that I've seen Blade Runner.
Yes.
Okay. Because, yes, I shamelessly ripped that off from Blade Runner.
Absolutely.
And because I liked it. I can't put it any better way. And,
no.
You know, it's out there. And if you actually, you know, if anybody goes through the series, you can find other obscure movie references or not so obscure movie references that I drop in every now and then.
Like I said, I have been loving the series. You are also author of the books Trust No One, The Secret World of Sidney Reilly. Available on Amazon. Secret Agent 666, that is the book that I got. That, as I said, earned you the Dudes of Beer badge of honor. And that only comes in a few ways. Number one, you cause such a kerfuffle on the pager group that, like, people leave the pager group. That means we're about to have a conversation that's, like, really good to me. If that kind of heat drops before, like, audio clip one hits. Aside from that, people like Mike Turber, who have been on, have gotten us onto the government radar where it's like, hey, your profile is being looked at on LinkedIn, and 90% of them are like U.S. government employees. and
yeah, I've run into some of that, yeah.
And then where you get us banned from social media because of the content of our episode. We've had that happen with people like John Hall, that kind of stuff. So those are a few of the ways that you earn the Dudes of Beer badge of honor, and welcome. You're out of the gate.
Thank
already
thank
have
you.
One.
I'm honored. Yes.
And even the first chapter of your book, Secret Agent 666, the way it is written, the way that you narratively tie these things together is so well woven, so well done.
Thank you.
Now, starting to get into secret societies real quick, I do have another clip real quick before we get into things, and that is the first minute that is kind of the course intro. Before we get into this, I want people to understand the way in which this course approaches things, aside from that view of history that you were talking about, because I think, like I was saying in our pre-conversation, to demystify these things for people is my job. I want to know as much detailed information as possible so that we can form an educated opinion. And you kind of have to look at these things dispassionately when you do that, folks. Believe me, I'm the biggest. I will dig rabbit holes all day long, Professor. But the second I hit a brick wall of fact that cannot be moved or anything like that, I'm not going to dig that tunnel anymore. Because there it is, you know. And the way that you have put forth a lot of this series, I think, really was wrapped up in that kind of preamble that happened at the end of episode one that was really only about 8 minutes long. But you really lay down what the concept of the show is. And I want to lay that out for our audience real quick before we dive into this. So please do check this out, everybody.
So who am I to claim expertise about secret societies or any other subject? Maybe a more important question is, what personal connection do I have with secret societies? Well, none. I am not now, nor have I ever been, the member of any secret society. And I've never really wanted to be. To me, joining any such organization ultimately means putting myself under someone else's authority. Of course, I even felt that way about the Boy Scouts. I'm just too independent, or a loner, or whatever, to put up with that. But a big part of what fascinates me about secret societies is what draws other people to them. In this series of lectures, we'll jump into some of history's deepest and darkest rabbit holes. We'll explore the fascinating, often mystifying, sometimes disturbing, occasionally inspiring world of brotherhoods, sisterhoods, orders, cults, and cabals that have influenced human culture from ancient times to the present. Secret societies have attracted some of history's most brilliant and some of its most evil minds. Often demonized by their enemies, many secret societies have become the stuff of myths and conspiracy theories. Why do they exist? And when they are invented or imagined, why would someone pretend they exist? What do secret societies believe? Who do they recruit? Most importantly, what influence do they have? Buckle up and get ready to find out.
And I think that is a perfect intro to this show, because it really is, like you said, in that just the fact of these secret societies are everywhere. They're all over the place. We've seen them throughout history. But are they really that secret? Or is it the product of imagination? Is it the product of myth? Is it the possible product of purposeful myth in order to mislead those that do not belong, even? In those words, do not belong, like they just are not members of the secret society.
Well, it's, you know, one of the things I think we were talking about before the show regularly started, mm-hmm. And I think I made a comment that, you know, having been in higher education for 40 years in the University of Idaho for over 30, and having taught this and a variety of other courses, there are things I would say that I am generally, overall, I am less certain about the world now than I was when I was much younger.
Yeah.
And that all has to do with the stuff that I've encountered and learned. And you know, you tend to think that every little bit of knowledge you come across sort of enlightens you, and it does in a way, but often what it enlightens you to is that what you believed before or what you thought was true isn't.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it is a, we live in a sea of information, but we also, within that sea, a large part of it is disinformation.
Yes.
And there is this critical difference between misinformation and disinformation. Misinformation is stuff that's just wrong. You know,
yeah.
Somebody tells you a phone number and you don't remember it correctly and you get it wrong. That's a mistake. Misinformation is an error.
Yep.
Disinformation is something completely different. Disinformation is information which may, in large part, be true, but it also contains falsehoods that are designed to lead you away from the truth. That is, it's something which is deliberately designed to misinform and mislead.
That's right.
And generally, if you look behind that, it's not generally not one person who's doing that. It's more than one, and that's, again, where you find our overused word to some degree, but it's always around a conspiracy, a conspiracy to mislead.
Yes, yes. And that's something that we, number one, just so you know, we actually use the term hypothesis on this show, because conspiracy theory is now, of course, a marked word by the FBI algorithms. So conspiracy hypothesis, we're going to follow the scientific principles, hypothesis, then theory. You're allowed to hypothesize anything. So that's kind of the point, is that if you're not thinking outside of the box, are you really thinking? And that's the point that you were bringing up about history. If you're only following what the status quo says, and you find something that's not within that status quo, like, it's hard not to want to push that. And at the same time, you have to push that, you know?
Well, this is what a lot of it boils down to. Human beings as individuals lie. Okay, now, I mean, you know, we try to avoid that, and it's wrong and all, but let's face it, we've all told lies. And often we've told lies for a very simple reason, because lies are easier than the truth.
Yes.
And let's put it this way. See, the truth, again, as I said to begin with, you know, real things are messy. You know, events happen, and you can't quite explain them, and... You know, I mean, I'm sure pretty much everybody out there has realized in some cases that, you know, a kind of lie is a story that I can invent and control, and it will make much more sense than the truth. You know, you ever heard your saying, if I told you the truth, you wouldn't believe it because I can't even make sense out of it.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you a story you can believe. Well, you know, the reality is that stuff has been going on in all of our cases all of our lives. Okay, it started with our parents,
yeah,
who remember in many cases. Here's a kind of silly example, but it gives you an idea of what I mean. Santa Claus. All right, let's face it, people. Santa Claus is a lie. All right, it's a lie that adults think is somehow cute to convince kids of.
You're lucky because that this is 18 and up. That's cold
as
ice.
Okay,
Band-Aid off, man.
there was a Christmas party at my in-laws some years ago where, you know, I did perhaps have too much eggnog and admitted to a niece that there was no Santa Claus. I've never lived that down.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I'm that uncle too.
But see, the thing was, I was telling her the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
I was telling her the truth. Her parents and everyone else there was lying to her and telling her and selling her this complete fiction. By the way, with the element of controlling them, because let's face it, the whole thing with Santa Claus is this guilt trip that he'll come and he'll punish you in a way that we're too gutless to punish you for, but we'll blame it on him.
Well, and so what's interesting is to even go culturally into that, go across the globe and start looking at it, and the other cultures are not afraid to punish at all. Start getting into the realm of Black Peter. That's when you start getting into Krampus. Like, he will come and drag you away in his sack to beat your soul with chains because you were bad.
Or they'll come and put you in a sack and sell you to the Turks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
There you go.
Like, yo. But like you're saying, the fact that this is done by numerous people in order to complete a paradigm, in order to complete a thought form, that makes it literally the realm of conspiracy. Conspiracy, by definition, and I say it on this show all the time, conspiracies have to exist. Otherwise, like, there's a lot of people that need to be let out of prison, and a whole lot of conspiracy, quote, theorists out there called DAs that are out of jobs.
Well, you know, conspiracy theory is used as a dismissive insult.
Yes.
Okay. Whenever someone says, well, this person is a conspiracy theorist, what they're really saying is that this person is a kook and you shouldn't pay any attention to them. A conspiracy theory, the mere fact that you call it a conspiracy theory is that you're not directly saying it, but you're implying that it's a bunch of BS.
Yes.
And therefore you shouldn't believe it. You're not bothering to explain why it's BS. You're just labeling it a conspiracy theory, which means you should ignore this and look away. And go from there. So yeah, it's become a term which is, you know, what I try to get across to students when we're talking about history and use example is that, well, there are all kinds of conspiracy theories, and some of those might be true, and some of them, maybe most of them aren't. But the other thing about history is that it's full of conspiracy facts.
That's
okay.
Right.
And you know, if you look at, here again is a simple explanation, assassination of Abraham Lincoln, all right? Well, that is a conspiracy. Why? Because it's got several people involved in a plot to kidnap or kill a president of the United States. It is a classic conspiracy, yet it's almost never addressed that way. You know, the preferred way that it's taught is that, well, there was this crazy guy named John Wilkes Booth, and he shot the president, and we'll leave out his fellow conspirators because, well, that turns it into a conspiracy, and
well,
that's too complicated.
Well,
and then we'll, we don't know whose conspiracy
it was.
The
fact that Burr was attacked the same night, like they tried taking out the president, vice president, and the secretary of state. Boom, all at one time.
So that, you know, that's a conspiracy. The assassination of Franz Ferdinand that set off World War One. That's a conspiracy. You know what the Nazis were convicted of at Nuremberg, by the way, was the conspiracy to wage aggressive war. All right, so that's what it is. I mean, conspiracy exists in terms of conspiracy fact.
Yeah,
think of it this way: every backroom political deal made in every country in every century is a conspiracy.
That's right.
Because it involved a small group of people acting in secret to attain a common goal. Doesn't have to be evil, doesn't have to be criminal. It's just something that they do in secret to attain their particular goal out of sight from everyone else. So, you know, the history is pretty much conspiracy facts in one form or another.
Exactly, and I cannot tell, I don't have my applause button handy. I cannot tell you what a deep sigh of relief moment it is whenever I get to hear a professor come on and define things exactly the way that we define them on this show for that exact reason. Because that is what a conspiracy is, and whenever you're dismissing that, you are the one dismissing fact now. And I mean, you can go on and on. I had the conversation with somebody on Facebook the other day, and I was like, hey man, there were people for years that said the Gulf of Tonkin never happened. Lo and behold, it didn't. And that just came about like in the last few years, didn't really happen. So it's one of those like, these things have happened throughout history. Let's kind of start cracking the nut a little bit of, the Hellfire Club, things like that, because like we said, and just so you know, folks, open disclosure, your host is a part of a secret society. I'm a fourth degree Knight of Columbus. Cannot tell anybody about the means by which you come into the Knights of Columbus, what happens behind those closed doors, all that kind of stuff. But I can tell you, we give a lot of money to charity, and we do a lot of bingo and stuff. And catfish fries. And if you think that that is something nefarious, come on out and try some catfish. I've even heard the conspiracies about the Knights of Columbus. And it's interesting. I know numerous Masons, things like that. And yes, there are upper ranks of Masons. There are different branches of Mason. And we'll be getting into some of that. But let's kind of start going into this Age of Enlightenment period where the U.S. really started its rebellion. It was shortly before France really got its independence, things like that. And the real influence behind these, quote, secret societies like the Hellfire Club, of which Benjamin Franklin was a part, Masons, things like that.
Well, the Hellfire Club, okay, like, one of the things in common between the Hellfire Clubs, which were basically the rich guy clubs, all right, those are still very much around today. I mean, I don't know, think of Jeffrey Epstein's Island. There you go.
Oh,
I
mean, man.
But I want to bring him up because there have been Jeffrey Epsteins throughout history.
Absolutely.
There was nothing, the template that he had, you know, basically providing a private getaway for, you know, questionable sexual hijinks to wealthy friends is a time-honored model.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what the Hellfire Club was.
Yep.
So that's the Hellfire Club really turns out to be the Hellfire Clubs, none of which pretty much were ever officially called Hellfire Club. So it's like I say about Freemasonry. Freemasonry is a house of many rooms. There are lots of different people with different motivations and different beliefs who have called themselves Freemasons.
Yeah.
So any time someone tells you, well, Freemasonry is this, that, and the other thing, well, they're talking about their particular flavor of it, but they're not talking about the many, many others that are out there. So it depends upon who's describing it. Hellfire Clubs basically, you know, they pop up in public view in the early 18th century, you know, in the 1700s. You know, the century of the American and French Revolution, the century that's called the Enlightenment, you know, which implies that everybody became more educated and smarter than they were before.
Implies.
Which really isn't. Mm. Yeah, see, the other interesting thing, if you look at the 18th century closely, you'll find out that, yes, there was a great deal of interest in science and reason, but right along with that, there was also an increased interest in mysticism and the occult. And
yes,
those two things were constantly intertwined with each other because they're both about the same thing. They're both, whether you're pursuing it through scientific means or you're pursuing it through metaphysical means, you're after enlightenment. I mean, really, you're after the secrets of life and death, aren't you?
Yeah.
That's what it is that you want. To become, you know, master of the secrets of the universe. And there are different ways of going about it. So anyone, you know, in the enlightenment, people were seeking enlightenment through a number of different means. So the first Hellfire Clubs, the first gentlemen clubs that came up with the name, actually show up in Ireland around, I don't know, 1715, you know, really early in the 1700s. And they show up in Ireland, some others show up in Scotland, they then eventually make their way into England, but they all had one thing in common. They were all essentially rich, often aristocratic men, because it costs money to belong to these things.
Yep.
Who got together for, well, you know, here's a modern equivalent. I bet a lot of you, and certainly you, Chris, and others out there who are listening have heard about the Bohemian Club, right? Bohemian Grove.
Indeed.
Okay. Bunch of rich guys getting out of the redwood, dressing up in robes, you know, carrying out mock sacrifices and full of giant talking owls. Well, here you get the same sort of question about that. Is this just a lot of rich guys, you know, kind of getting off in the woods, right? Okay, they're just out, you know, it's like summer camp for the uber wealthy, all right? And it's all sort of fun and games, and none of it is meant seriously, and it's, you know, just guys having a good time in private.
Yeah.
With hookers. So
lots of hookers.
Lots and lots of hookers. Always an important part of the fun, you know, no fun without hookers. So you see, you've got the same thing. I mean, in many ways, the Bohemian Club is just a 19th century San Francisco reinvention of the Hellfire Club.
Absolutely.
So these things have always been around. So the question becomes, to what extent is this just a bunch of rich guys having a good time and dressing up in silly costumes and, you know, maybe performing things that kind of look like satanic rituals but are really just kind of a mockery of that?
Yeah.
Or is it exactly what it looks like? Okay, in other words, but you
stranger
see,
than fiction, but is it exactly what it looks like?
And this is where you get into the tricky part. In in history or anything else, you can observe something happening. Okay, so we know that in certain dates in Dublin or Belfast, later in London, there were various gentlemen's clubs called the Hellfire Clubs. They had an exclusive membership. They generally involve things that looked like pagan rites. There are a lot of sex, alcohol, and probably drugs involved. A lot of behavior that wouldn't be acceptable in ordinary society.
Yeah.
That's one of the things about it.
And, you know, that is even covered in the diaries of James Madison. Whenever he talks about his personal convoys that he made over to France with Benjamin Franklin, and some of the crazy debaucherous things that he saw him do over there, and he was like, "Hey, you got to understand, this is just part of French politics." Don't get me wrong, this is fun and everything, but this is also like part of their politic culture, and if you can't do this, you're gonna have a real bad problem in the State Department, my friend.
Well, here's the question: when you observe this happening, okay, you're Madison or you're someone, and you watch these guys engaging in all this bizarre behavior.
Yeah.
The question in virtually everything, and it's not just in these kind of clubs, but for every person in every situation, is what is in that person's mind and heart?
Yeah.
All right? What, you see, the ultimate secret society, or the origin, I think, of all sort of secretiveness, is the secretiveness that exists within each person. Because another thing to keep in mind is that we all guard certain aspects of ourselves. There, you know, we have different gradations of privacy. There are things that we will share openly with other people. There are things you'll only talk about with members of your family. Yep. There are things you'll only talk about, you know, with your husband or wife or significant other. And then there are the things that you never talk about with anyone but yourself. And there aren't many of those things, but there's always some little part of us that we keep secret. Okay, that is the one thing, and not necessarily because there's anything, you know, bad or anything else about it. It's just, you know, it's just one of those things that you couldn't really describe it to anyone else. You know, I don't know. It's like trying to describe why you like this flavor of ice cream and you don't like another one. I don't know. You just do. So there is this, there's always this aspect of the hidden that exists within people. And then when you get like-minded people together, people who find out they have common interests, they can often kind of share those interests. I mean, you know, most of us are geeks about something, right? All right.
Yeah.
We have a kind of, you know, geeky, nerdish interest in things. And one of the things you tend to figure out pretty early on is that only you and a few other people are really interested in this stuff, and that it bores other people silly. So you just quit talking about it in front of them.
Yeah.
And sometimes you run across people, I don't know, who like to talk about secret societies on the radio, and they just talk about it all the time. All right. So, you know, you've suddenly got an audience, all right? And you've got people who kind of understand what you're talking about and can share things with you. And that, you know, that's what, and then that forms, you know, all kinds of things can come out of that. Fan clubs, secret orders of one kind or another. It's finding those common interests that link people together that often separate them from other ones. But you never really know. I mean, if I was looking at a group of, you know, wealthy men or anybody, you know, any group of human beings carrying out what appeared to be a kind of, you know, sexually themed, you know, maybe some sort of, you know, vaguely ritualistic orgy. I mean, is this just because they're just doing this for fun? Or is there some more serious component about it? And I would bet you that if you went around to those people and you could see inside each one of them individually, you would realize that for some of them it is just fun, and for some of them it's something much more serious.
Yeah.
It's something approaching almost a religious action. And that's what, from the outside, isn't visible, because you don't know what kind of emotional or intellectual response this person is having to those things. So that when you look at something like these, you know, 18th century gentlemen's clubs, And mm-hmm. you know, one of the very common in them, I mean, you know, it generally involved drinking, it involved sex, and it involved a lot of things that you might identify as kind of, certainly they weren't Christian rituals, let's put it that way.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
They were often mockeries of religious rituals, or they were things that harkened back to paganism. And when you get to the most well-known and the most historically famous of the Hellfire Clubs, that was the one that was founded really in the 1840s by an important English nobleman by the name of Sir Francis Dashwood. And that's the one that Benjamin Franklin was connected with. He was a friend of Dashwood's. Dashwood was a friend of his. Franklin, who again, you know, was a guy who really liked to party and party hard, would show up at meetings of that order. And in Dashwood's case, I mean, he embraced the whole kind of pagan revival thing head on. You know, he put up statues to the Greek gods, the veneration of the goddess of love and sexual ecstasy, Venus, Diana. Yeah, on his estate, he created underground grottos where you know, parties or rituals could be carried out. He, you know, leased an old abbey. And, you know, the guys who showed up there would show up dressed like monks. They would bring in cartloads of prostitutes dressed like nuns, and hijinks ensued. You know, you dress up a monkey like the Pope and put him on put him on a throne and revere him. So is that a joke? Is that just kind of anti-papist mockery? Or is that something more akin to an out-and-out black mass? Well, it's not the actions, it's the intent of those actions.
Yes.
But it really raises, you know, the question always is, what exactly is going on here, and how far does it go? Also, there's a thing that people can start out doing stuff as a joke, and then it can suddenly turn serious.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that you bring up the dressing up the monkey as the Pope, things like that, and whether it's the actions or the intent of the actions. One of the things that a lot of people don't realize is, because at one point in your series you reference Mardi Gras. And traditional Mardi Gras, they actively wear large pointed hats, masks, things like that. It was actively something that was done to poke fun at the royalty in Lower France at the time, things like that. And that's kind of the cultural history behind it, and it's interesting to see where that has come to in our modern understanding now, and that the public face of Mardi Gras is something totally different than the actual tradition of Mardi Gras.
Yeah, there are things. I think I make a couple of references in one lecture. One where I'm talking about ancient mystery cults, okay, which isn't a very common topic. But, you know, if you go back to Greece and Rome, think of it this way. If you go back to Rome, the religion that many, maybe most people actually practiced wasn't sort of a worship of a bunch of gods. You would generally pick one or two that you would kind of devote yourself to, like saints, you might do later.
Yeah, you had a statue on your hearth, things like that.
Yeah, a lot of religious fervor was sort of put into mystery cults, which would revolve around things like the Egyptian goddess Isis, or this kind of phony Persian god. I mean, phony in the sense that he wasn't really a Persian god, but he was a god, Mithras. And people would devote themselves to that exclusively. And these were all sort of, they were secret societies in the sense that you had to be recruited. You had to swear. Generally what went on within the mystery cult was, you know, the reason it's a mystery cult is that it's secret. Only the initiated can speak about it. And you can find, if you look at what was one of the most popular mystery cults in the Roman Empire, which was the cult of the originally Egyptian goddess Isis, one of the things you got in that is that there was a whole festival that was dedicated to her, and it involved taking her image, putting it on a cart. People would adorn the cart. They would put on costumes. They would carry it down to the harbor, and they didn't throw beads, but they did throw food or gifts.
Yep.
I mean, it's in that.
Yeah.
You know, either it's a strange case of something reappearing in a similar form, or there is, and I would be willing to accept there's some kind of vague but direct descent from those old practices in what eventually appeared or reappeared in Mardi Gras.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a reason why one of the big parties for Mardi Gras, especially in New Orleans, is the Janus Party. Things like that. I found it very interesting that you were going into the Knights of Malta, even in your series. And just to start backtracking this a little bit and connecting it, once again, this is going into the way that secret societies really kind of societally fit in a lot of different facets that we really don't think about. Like you were saying in the preamble to the show, they aren't necessarily secret. You lay down four kind of hallmarks of what a secret society is. And as we kind of delve into this topic, let's go over those four hallmarks real quick. So that as we get into the Hellfire Club a little bit more and start delving into the Masons in early America, we can really see what those hallmarks are and see how they're repeated throughout time, throughout different societies that we may see all around.
Well, one of the things you already mentioned was that in a lot of cases, they're not secret at all. Everybody knows about them.
Yeah.
So again, if you go back to ancient Rome, everybody knew that the Eleusinian mysteries and the Issician mysteries existed. The point was, you didn't know what they, you knew they existed, but you didn't know anything about the mysteries unless you remember. So the first important criteria of a secret society is that the membership is by invitation. You're recruited, or more importantly, you are chosen. That's the whole
right.
thing.
That's right.
All right. That's what makes you special. You are chosen to be a member, and not everybody can, because there's some sort of criteria by which some people are chosen and others are not. And that's one of those issues that probably one of the things it does, you know, people like to be part of, think of it this way, a club that everybody can belong to isn't much of a club, is it? But a club that only certain people can belong to, well, everybody likes being special, and by being chosen by this particular group, they have made you special in their way. So you have to be chosen. The next one is that once you're chosen, you have to go through some kind of initiation. The initiation might be simple, it might be complicated, it might take a few minutes, it might take months, but there's an initiation. And as part of that initiation, you go through rituals, and most importantly, you are sworn to secrecy about what goes on within the society. So that becomes a key component. Once you are chosen, and once you are initiated, you keep your mouth shut.
Yes.
Now, I bet there are people listening who have been members of either fraternities or sororities in college.
Yep.
And one of the things that they might be thinking about is that, that kind of sounds like being initiated into a fraternity. That's right, because they're secret societies. Okay. I mean, they are.
We don't call
they're
each other brother for nothing.
No, I mean, look, why do they have their...
Fraternity means brotherhood.
Think of it this way. You've got Greek letters that represent them, right? Well, one of the things you're going to learn is that those Greek letters are stands for words, which are often connected to something about the organization itself.
Mm-hmm.
But see, that's hidden. Here you have... So a fraternity or a sorority will advertise its existence all across campus, and everyone will know that they're the Phi Deltas, but nobody can tell you exactly what Phi Delta stands for, okay?
Yep.
That's one of the secrets. It's even written in a foreign alphabet,
yep.
Just to make it that much more mysterious.
Yeah, even more obfuscated.
So you got to keep your mouth shut, okay? There's no talking about what it goes on. And the third thing is that once you've been sworn to secrecy, the society offers to impart some kind of special knowledge, power, or status. All right? So remember, one of the things about being rushed into a fraternity. One of the things about eventually being chosen as a brother in a fraternity is that other people who tried to do that weren't chosen.
Yeah.
You're special. You were picked to belong to this, and now you're going to be sworn to loyalty to the group. And, you know, the advantage you ostensibly get out of being part of a Greek organization is that, you know, you'll make friends for life who will then be useful in your post-college career. In other words, you're going to network and conspire.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it comes down to. I mean,
yeah.
Here's an interesting question. What exactly is the difference between networking and conspiring?
That is, you know, and what's interesting, I as an owner of a podcast network, I literally akin, because I came to you via social network. I liked your series. I loved it. I did my typical thing. Went on to my platform of choice for professionals, approached you, gave you a little bit of info, and was like, I would love to have you on my show to just demystify this topic. And we began a relationship. But it is quite literally no different than old school spycraft, people. There is no real secret. How did the old school spies get in? They came in and they said, hey, I'm here to fix the telephone. And they dressed up like a telephone guy. And then they talked to the front door person. And then they came in next month. Hey, I'm here to fix the telephone. How you doing? Next thing you know, you can walk in anytime you want. They're on the phone. You don't even have to talk to them. They just wave at you. And that's the original social network. It's quite literally that asset process of espionage.
Yeah, if you're going to be normally recruited in for an intelligence agency, one of the first things that happens is that you are vetted, which means that they check you out.
That's
right. And
they
only check you out without you knowing that.
Yeah.
And once they have determined that your membership, you know, potential, then they bring you in further and you're gradually cultivated. And at some point, the offer of service gets sprung on you. Okay?
Mm.
We think that you could be useful to us. We would like you to work for us. And if you're willing to do so, you would. But one of the first things, of course, you're going to have to do is keep your mouth shut.
And,
all right.
You know, I find it very interesting that you yourself, as somebody who has literally taught this topic, like Russian espionage and American espionage for like 30 years, like most people don't even realize that colleges are one of the biggest recruiting grounds for these intelligence agencies.
Yes.
They go into computer programs. They, you know, into these programs at colleges. They go into psychology, sociology. They find people that are good at these things, and that is where they recruit from, straight up.
Well, I could go back to my grad student days at UC Santa Barbara, and I was
UC
actually
was a
part of
it.
Pardon?
UC, just all of California was a big area for recruitment and such things.
Well, I was in something that was called the Balkan Studies Program. Okay, it's Balkan and Eastern European Studies. They didn't have a Russian Studies Program, so that was as close as you could get. But all of the people who went into that were interested in Eastern Europe. Now, remember, this is the 1970s. It's the Cold War, and the Iron Curtain exists. And so what you had were a lot of people who were studying countries and issues that probably at some point in their professional futures would see them traveling into Eastern, you know, into the Soviet bloc doing research. Now ask yourself, who might be potentially interested in those people? You know, people who will professionally be able to travel in the communist Eastern bloc.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I never paid any particular attention to at the time, and I'm going to have to be very careful here about not mentioning people's names, because I don't know who's still alive, but there was a fellow in the program. He was ostensibly a master's student, but what he was is that he was a retired military officer, an Air Force officer, I believe. And he was very nice, and I knew him on a number of occasions, but he was there, and he was always kind of working on his master's. I guess at some point he eventually completed it. But to put the pieces together that I only sort of realized years later is that he basically was the CIA spotter in that program.
Wow.
And now I realize that, oh, yeah, of course he was. I mean, there had to be one. This was, you know, one of the few sort of Balkan studies programs in the whole country. So, yes, it was there. And then thinking back on that, I now realize that, oh, yeah, okay, so that's why he did that.
Yeah.
But it wasn't something that was in any way obvious. It wasn't something that was, you know, he didn't, you know, sneak around and, you know, cloak and dagger, not that type of thing. No, he was just kind of this older, friendly, retired guy, you know, who asked lots of questions.
What's interesting is the fact that you have literally gone through all of these things as it has happened, even in it, within your time of research from your master's to now, what has happened with the Cold War, with Russia,
yeah,
Glasnost, everything, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the espionage that has gone on since, not only culturally, but politically, technologically, all that kind of stuff. You have been there live and for that. What has that been like for you to kind of see these things unfold as somebody who studies that field in particular?
Well, you know, everything happens just a little bit at a time. And, you know, when things are happening, you often don't pay much attention to them because it's just like one little increment. So the first time I ever taught modern Russian history, which was also at UC Santa Barbara, you know, the Soviet Union, that was like 1981. The Soviet Union was still going strong. You know, the Warsaw Pact and the Eastern Bloc still existed. The Cold War was still in full swing. So when I talked about modern Russian history, if I was going to talk about 20th century Russian history, well, you know, 1917 brought in the communist regime, and hey, it's still there. So I'm talking about a political order that was still seemingly very much in control at that time. Now, skip ahead 10 years to 1991, and the USSR goes belly up.
Yeah.
Pretty abruptly, all right?
Yeah.
And by the way, when there are a lot of people running around today going, oh, well, I saw that coming, and we all know, nobody did, really. I mean, certainly not in the historical sphere. It took everybody by surprise. And then you just had to kind of deal with a new reality. I mean, you had to go and you said, well, you know, we're talking about modern Russian history, you know, which just keeps getting longer and longer and longer. And so then you go from the fall of the USSR to the Yeltsin regime and then all of the chaos of the 1990s and then the rise of Vladimir Putin. And now you're in a different kind of Russian paradigm. But the other thing that you can see, that one of the things that the study of history gives you, is you can see that, yeah, it's all different, but it's also pretty much the same. Right?
Yeah, it very much follows the same.
The old saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah.
Okay, that is one of the guiding issues there. You know, and you still... You know, you have a regime which is ostensibly democratic, but is really pretty much authoritarian, a kind of dominant political. Yeah, so you could look at it, essentially, you can look at from czarism through the Soviet period into the post-Soviet period. There are things that change, but there's also this kind of constant. It's as if water always kind of finds its own, you know, its own level. That the, you know, the Russian ship of state or any other tends to right itself, and when it rights itself, it comes back into a position very similar to what it had before. And it's an interesting thing if you look at the Russian Revolution or you look at any other revolutions, you know, like the French or the American revolutions in the 18th century.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way. For the average American, you know, in the period of the Revolution, you know, let's say someone who lived through rule by the king, the revolution and then the establishment of the United States as a Republican form of government, for the average person, life didn't change at all.
Nope.
No. I mean, if you were a dirt farmer before, you were a dirt farmer previously. Yeah. If you were middle class, you were... I mean, nothing changed socially. The rich who were rich before were still rich. Yeah. The poor were still poor. The middle were still the middle.
The one thing that we point on this show all the time is, like, directly after our war for independence of no taxation without representation, we had our first civil war, which was the whiskey rebellion, where quite literally whiskey makers were like, hey, wait a minute, you're going to tax us all this money because we have really clean water and we don't have representatives yet? Didn't we just get finished with the whole kerfuffle about that?
I mean, not only we're going to tax you, we're going to tax you more than the king was taxing you.
Yeah, exactly. So it was, you know, because we got to pay back our debt. And that was quite literally the plan of the treasury. That was like, it was like, well, how can we pay back this debt in a right good amount of time? Well, you know, we can't tax beer because everybody drinks beer, but spirits,
like, yeah, I mean, there was the Whiskey Rebellion, there was Shays Rebellion,
absolutely.
And, you know, because the state of Massachusetts, to pay off its war debts, decided, well, we're going to tax land. We can do that. So all the farmers, especially in western and Massachusetts, now got hit with these heavy tax bills because, well, you know, freedom has a cost, and that cost is going to be taxes on your land, or we're just going to come in and take it.
They don't call it Taxachusetts for nothing.
No, that you know, that again, just it, the kind of consistent theme that runs across. So, yeah, I mean, it, you know, for most people, life tends to stay pretty much the same, which means that the movement, what you actually see in most revolutions is that most people, you know, the poor stay poor, but what you see is a reshuffling of control among, if I dare use this term, the elites.
Yes.
All right?
Yes.
Those people who had power and money before just kind of, you know, change positions, acquire more or less power, but pretty much that's all that you have. You have a kind of shift in the elites, and then life goes on for everybody else.
Yeah.
But see, that's why secret societies can become a very important mechanism in those political movements, because very often these elites are members of them before they become revolutionary.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because it was during the research for another book entirely that you first really came into your research into Masons, which is... of course, our second part of tonight, talking about Masonic history in America and its influence in the founding of America. And as we start kind of getting into this topic of the American Revolution here, and kind of wrapping up the Russian revolutions, it was your research into this Russian revolutionary and his random connections to people, where, like, if you were societally just looking at someone, even from the aspect of a police investigator and going, how is this dude connected with all these people? It was just utterly random until you started digging in and found the fact that he was a Mason. And so were these other connections.
Yeah, he, again, this fellow I mentioned before, Boris Savinkov. Mm-hmm. Savinkov politically was a socialist. Okay, that's what he called himself. And so he was on the left end of the political spectrum. He was a revolutionary. You know, he'd actually plotted to assassinate the Tsar before 1917 on a number of occasions. But during the revolutionary ferment, at one point, he has a kind of, you know, some political and military authority in this town. And he has a member of, actually, of the Romanov family, of the dynasty.
Oh, wow.
Come to him and say, look, I'm kind of trapped in this town, and I think I'm in danger. Could you help me get out? I want to get out of here. And now you would think that Savinkov, the revolutionary socialist, wouldn't lift a little finger to help a member of the imperial family.
Yeah.
But he does. And that was the thing that I kept thinking, oh, why is he doing that? I mean, he didn't really know this guy. It wasn't like they were friends or anything. Well, the explanation for it, you know, to cut to the chase, is that they're both members of the same Masonic Lodge. And what it was that the Grand Duke appealed to him as a brother Mason to help him. In other words, whatever our other differences, whatever our political differences and everything aside, we as members of this oath-sworn secret brotherhood, one of the things that we're sworn to do is to help each other in times of distress, and I, as a brother Mason, ask your help, and Savinkov, as a brother Mason, gave it to him.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about it is that that transcended politics. It had nothing to do with politics. Suddenly they were operating on this completely different level.
Well,
and then it was one of those things that began to make kind of sense of some of other of Savinkov's associations, and it's one of the things that I'd suggest to people that if you find historical figures or, you know, people you work with who you can't figure out what the connection is between them, that could be it. It could be a lot of other things, but that might be one of the things that binds them together.
Yeah, and it really is, like you're saying, that fraternity outside of things. That's one of the interesting facts of the Masons, actually, is that in theory, there is no politics or talk of politics allowed inside the sanctuary. Once you are inside of those doors, all politics is dropped. Doesn't matter what color you vote, things like that. And as this Age of Enlightenment was happening across the globe, and especially here in America with the American Revolution going on, to have that concept that we will become politically mute, I think is really interesting. That they tried to, and if you go through and even read the writings of the Founding Fathers, if you go through and read the Federalist Papers, things like that, you very much see that dispassionate, stoic, philosophic approach to things, especially when it comes to tyranny, resetting things, many issues that we're facing in our country and in our politic right now, where people have just kind of forgotten this concept is there and written in for reasons.
Yeah, traditionally the two things you weren't supposed to discuss in a lodge were politics and religion.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very simple reason for that, because those are the two main things that people will argue about.
Yep.
Okay. Go into a bar, have people start talking about politics and religion, and sooner or later a fight will break out. Okay?
That's right.
So in the context, remember, of the Brotherhood of the Lodge, one of the reasons why you avoided those topics in the meeting was that, one, you are now involved in a quest for a kind of higher form of fellowship and spiritual knowledge that transcended those things. But the other fact that it was also just practical. If you involve that into the Lodge proceedings itself, it would politicize the Lodge and it would cause dissension. On the other hand, there's nothing to say that 5 minutes after the lodge meeting was over, and you also weren't supposed to drink during the lodge either, but when you adjourned to the tavern, well, then the same group of guys, exactly the same group of guys, could sit down and talk politics. But remember, they're the same group of people, and what them together, the reason why they're talking politics in the tavern is because they are brothers in the lodge. And those two things thus are, in a mysterious and unfathomable way, both separate and bound together at the same time.
Yeah, and very much so, and that is very much the concept of operation of this show, is the fact that the public house was where everybody met. Didn't matter if you were the mayor or a representative or a pig farmer. Everybody went to the pub whenever they went to town. And that is where you talked about religion and politics, and things got ruckus. But you know what? We came back the next week whenever we went to market, and we occupied the same stool, and the dude that sat at the bar was the guy who lived across the fence from us, you know, and we still had these open conversations. And like you're saying, these revolutions were planned in those places by folks of common thought, who already belonged to these societies and knew that, well, we're common enough of thought in this way. What can we do outside of there that we cannot do inside of there.
Yeah. I mean, you can go from, you know, having an initiation ritual to plotting revolution, and those two things are... See, the thing, remember, we talked about those characteristics of a secret society.
Yeah.
And the thing is that people are chosen. And the reason why people are chosen is that in some way or another, I mean, you know, this is the way we human beings are, we'll tend to choose people who are, you know, you have to have something in common with them.
Right? Yeah.
You're never going to pick somebody to be a member of your club who doesn't have anything in common with you. So if you've kind of vetted this person before, if you've collected some information on them, if you talk to them, what you tend to find within, whether it's Masonic or other secret societies, is that there will be a certain level, greater or lesser, of like-mindedness between people.
Mm.
Like attracts like. So to some degree, while there may be differences of opinion, you know, what you might find, let's say, in a colonial American Masonic lodge would be that, well, you know, some people wanted to remain loyal to the king because, you know, as a Freemason then you had to take an oath of loyalty to the king. And some people might have been more inclined to republicanism, but what they could all agree upon was that we don't like the present state of affairs.
Yeah.
All right. We don't like the way that we're being treated by the king's government. We don't like the way we're being treated by Parliament, and we think we should organize in something to do something about that. And we already have this basic fraternity, this brotherhood of like-minded men, who again can almost seamlessly go from, you know, participating in the esoteric teachings of the lodge to then involving themselves in a political plot against the crown. And that doesn't happen in all cases, but it certainly happens in some. I mean, here again is one of those connections I could make between the Russian Revolution and the French Revolution and the American Revolution. All right.
Okay.
All of them were heavily influenced by people who were members of Masonic lodges. I mean, in the Russian case, probably even more than the American and French case. And these are relatively small groups of people. But if you then began to actually look at the political movers and shakers, you find out that, you know, not everybody's a Mason, but a hell of a lot of them are.
Yeah.
And more than you would find any... I mean, out of all proportion... I mean, here's, I think, in one of the lectures I go over, the, you know, the rough numbers. You could probably figure that in... The American colonies in 1775, there were hundreds of thousands. There may have been as many as 500,000 adult males in the colonies who could theoretically qualify for Masonic membership.
Yeah.
I mean, theoretically. That is, they were the right age. They were male, all right? And those were... But how many of the, let's say, the 500,000 men who might have been Masons actually were Masons? 5,000 or 6,000 at most.
Yep.
I mean, a tiny, tiny proportion. So you've got the colonies that had somewhere around 3 million people. Keep in mind that includes everything from slaves, which were a very large proportion of it, you know, women, children, bond servants. But even out of the group that theoretically could be members of it, if you simply, you know, broke it down into essentially free white males age 21 or older, most of them, the vast majority of them, weren't Freemasons. Why not?
Yeah.
One, they couldn't afford it because lodge membership was largely for the wealthy. You know, you had to buy all those fancy, you know, doodads to wear.
Yeah,
that
there's
cost
a
money.
Lot of regalia.
Yeah, and that has a purpose, by the way. Not
it
only
does
it make you look... Does it make you look cool, all right? But the other thing is that it keeps out the riffraff. That's
yes.
what it's actually there for.
That's
all right?
Right. We can identify each other immediately.
Right. Okay, who's that guy
as,
standing
as
over there?
As a former sergeant of arms. Somebody who stood at the door. That was
right.
My job.
And, you know, this guy's got an apron. Okay. He's not a cook. Oh, I see. He's a Mason.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that was part of it, you know, by making the cost of membership, for, you know, it's like joining a country club. The dues are high to keep out the riffraff, and the same sort of thing functioned in the Masonic lodges. Now, you can go through, I give various figures in one of the lectures, but, you know, if you look at the Continental Army, if you look at the Continental Congress, if you look at the, you know, the Founding Fathers themselves, Again, some are Masons, some are not. Okay, George Washington, definitely. Okay, he had his whole picture, you know, painted in Masonic regalia.
Absolutely.
He didn't hide that fact. Thomas Jefferson, almost certainly, but he'd never publicly admit it. Benjamin Franklin, Benjamin Franklin would join any kind of a club in that way.
He was club.
Yes, if there was a club, I think if somebody was, you know, if he could get a free drink out of it, he was there.
But, oh, yeah. If he could place an ad in his own circular for it, he made it up. That's how industrious he was with it.
He was, he's a very interesting guy. He's much more than just some old, weird grandfather guy in a three-cornered hat flying a kite in the rain. Okay.
Yeah.
See, that's the way we're supposed to think about him. We don't think of Benjamin Franklin dressed up in a toga in an underground grotto at Francis Dashwood's Hellfire meeting with some drunken hookers gathered around him.
Yeah.
No, we don't think of him that way. But
no.
that's him as well.
Well, and, you know, even in recent archaeological digs on his property, they have found, like, skeletons in the basement, things like that. So, and of course, you know, what have you, they could have been there before the house was built. They didn't necessarily build foundations the way that we do now. Whether or not those were part of any Hellfire Club or other secret society is, of course, out there in the realm of conspiracy theory now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here again, you can sort of look at what the basic facts are. Okay. In a house, or rather, in the basement of a house that Benjamin Franklin would have lived in during this period, there are skeletons, body often which show signs of having been sawed or cut. But, you know, there are bodies buried in the basement of a house, and those bodies were probably buried. You know, you can't say they were buried there exactly when he was around, but, you know, around the time he was living in the house, somebody was burying bodies in the basement. That's the facts.
Like,
but the facts don't answer the question of who buried the bodies. Why did they bury the bodies?
No.
Was Benjamin Franklin involved? That's the theory.
Yeah, and that's where the theory comes in, and that's where you kind of have to have this hearsay and conjecture, because, like you were saying, the history is incomplete. We don't know. We haven't run across any chronicles. And believe me, Benjamin Franklin kept diaries out the wazoo. He was a prolific writer, all kinds of stuff. And there's nothing out there talking about him sacrificing a bunch of bodies. So I buried him last night in my basement. Hope the slaves don't find him whenever they go down to do the laundry tomorrow. You know, like, that is not anywhere in the documents of the Founding Fathers. It's not anywhere in a private diary, things like that. So, like you said, we all even personally have secrets outside of those things.
So, does that, you know, the fact that you don't find him confessing to murdering people and burying them in the basement, does it, the fact that the bodies were in the basement doesn't prove he had anything to do with them being there.
No.
Right? It simply opens the possibility that he might have.
That's right.
And the fact that he doesn't confess to killing people and burying them in the basement doesn't mean he didn't. It just means you don't have any evidence that he did.
That's right.
So, I mean, this is, again, something I think we were talking about before we went on the air, where I said that, you know, in a lot of the ways of approaching this, what you'd have to do, and I know this is going to sound weird to people, but I'm perfectly serious, don't believe anything, all right? Quit going into looking at something like this with the idea that, okay, I have to look at this and decide what's true, okay? Was Benjamin Franklin a perfectly nice guy, or was he some sort of, you know, serial killer? Well, the point is, you don't know, and you're never going to know, all right?
The historians don't know.
The historians don't know, and no one, the only thing you've got is that here are some kind of odd facts.
Yeah.
Which might suggest that he had some involvement in it, but that's all that it does. So when I say don't believe anything, it's because there's nothing there to believe. What do you believe? There's not enough information to form any belief about anything concrete. But that doesn't mean you should ignore it. No, you shouldn't. You should pay attention to that. You should log those facts, and you should keep that possibility in mind, and you should wait and see if someday other information comes along that would either support or refute it. But don't go into it thinking that you have to make a decision and believe something.
That's it. That's just it. And we talk about that on the show so many times about, the, like we said earlier, just accepting something as a point of datum. It's just another data point. It's just a piece of information in a set, added as a feather in your cap. And later on, we'll talk about feathers, maybe. You know, but as you move down the line, you can't let it lead to points of hearsay and conjecture. It's hard not to, but it really is one of those that you just kind of have to leave the hanging chad there and move forward to put it
You know, you can conjecture, you can speculate,
sure.
but just remember that that's what you're doing. You're speculating.
Yes,
all
right? That's right.
You're just kind of spitballing, but then the problem is that people start speculating, and then they start believing their speculation. All
yes.
Right? They're not believing in any sort of factual story because there aren't enough. You know, as somebody once put it, I can't remember who. You know, one of the things about historical facts is they just sit there like a turd on a plate. All right? And the question is, you know, like, why is there a turd on a plate? Okay, who would do that? Why is it there? I mean, think of it. If you came across that, not that you would want to, that would be disgusting, but that would be your idea.
But
who on earth put
fact.
The fact is
there's a turd on the plate. On the plate.
and you don't know. All you know is that there's a turd on the plate. Okay, that's the fact. Okay,
yeah.
How it got there, what they meant, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Precisely, and that is where hypothesis is necessary. Thinking outside the box is necessary. Anybody who's telling you it isn't, I think, is really trying to control a paradigm in some way, shape, or form. That just goes to me against any form of scientific method.
At that point, you've
got expected result. All kinds of issues.
Well, if you applied that to science, I'm not a scientist, but
no.
You know, as far as my understanding of it, if you applied it to science, you got a certain number, you know, you've got data points, you've got a certain amount of data, you've got some facts. They don't tell you very much. If no one ever speculated beyond the immediately available facts, we would never have gotten anywhere.
Yep.
All right? You wouldn't even come up with a doorknob.
And
so what you do in science, as I understand it, is that you take the available data and you form a hypothesis, i.e. you speculate, and then you test that hypothesis.
That's right.
All right? And if that doesn't work, you go to plan B and you come up with another hypothesis and you test that one until eventually you find one that works and keeps working. But to get there, you have to speculate. You have to consider possibilities. Think of it that way. You have to think of
That's
possibilities
right.
beyond what's immediately in front of you.
Yeah.
So there's nothing wrong. I mean, it's you know, speculation, hypothesizing, theory, whatever term you want to use to it, spitballing.
Absolutely.
All of that is an absolutely essential to advancing any kind of knowledge. But what you have to do in the process is not to fall in love with these things and start believing in them.
That's right. And that's where you come in, I think, so poignantly and so great. I am probably, I think I'm on episode 9 right now of the lecture series, which is fantastic. Great Courses is the name of it, folks. The Great Courses series, A Real History of Secret Societies, is what Professor Richard B. Spence is teaching. And has numerous more coming out, is what I love. I cannot wait to hear more topics from you. And the fact that they have released this kind of stuff, I think, is really great because it helps demystify these things for people. Like we're saying, it's not that these things don't exist. It's not that there weren't conspiracies within and without them. Sure. But are they nefarious ends the way that some conspiracy theories make? And
well,
the way
you know,
that some
I,
are? Like I said earlier, is that the case of maybe they even made the conspiracy theory that way just to make it more mysterious on their own?
Well, you know, you have groups who have to. And here's an interesting case. I think I may have mentioned this in a lecture. I'd say I have to remember what I said and what I didn't. A few years back at the University of Idaho, I was attending every year there's, we have a Naval ROTC, and, you know, I have students who are part of that, and they have a commissioning ceremony. And so I was invited to the commissioning ceremony, and I was sitting there in a small audience, and there was a representative of the local Masonic Scottish Rite, which is a kind of, special add-on of Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. And he came up and he gave a little speech, and his speech was kind of interesting to me because he goes, you know, Freemasons founded this country, you know? Okay, this is a Masonic Republic. And I thought, whoa. I've never heard anyone say that in public before.
Wow.
So, and, you know, but he gave it, but see, that was his opinion. That was what it was that he believed.
Sure.
And that may have been what he was told. Now, I was interested enough in that I didn't actually talk to him about it, but there was another fellow there who I knew was a Mason, and I said, well, what do you think about what that guy said? You know, I mean, I know you're not Scottish, right? But would you agree with what he said? And he goes, well, I think he was making too much out of it. You know, I think Freemasons had an influence on things, but I'd never say it was a Masonic Republic. So there's an interesting case. Two men who were both Freemasons.
Well,
both acknowledged a Masonic role in the revolution,
sure,
but they had a different take on it. Okay, they didn't seem to believe or accept the same things about it.
Yeah.
And thus I go back to those questions, you know, that Freemasonry is a house of many rooms, and that people who use that same name can, even within the Sorin organization, have different views about things.
Yeah, and one of the things that we talk about on this show regularly is the fact that politician was not an actual job at that point in America. There were envoys, there were political envoys, but hey, even people like Benjamin Franklin did not make his money as a politician. Like, he made money from being a politician, because he definitely made some business dealings over in France, things like that, while he was there. But he ran Poor Richard's Almanac, all kinds of things, and that's the thing. Much like it was expensive to belong to these societies, it was expensive to you had to be somebody of means, typically, in order to serve in that social service of public office, as a representative, as an envoy. You had to be somebody that could leave for a month, 2 months at a time, and go, okay, I'll see you later. Take care of the law practice, or, hey, take care of the big farm. You know, take care of the tobacco farm, everybody. I'll be back in 2 months when Congress is done meeting. And that was the thing. It was seen as a little bit different. And even Benjamin Franklin had the concept of our representatives should not be paid at all. At the very most, they should be, like, reimbursed for expenses. Like, if you had to spend money to spend time in Washington, we'll pay you back for that. But aside from that, you have means. You are all set. You're all good. That's why you can do this. You are not working in a field. So, and it's really interesting to have seen a lot of that kind of passed by the wayside, and really pushed away from our politic, and that concept of enlightenment of these forefathers, whenever you're talking about it being a Masonic Republic, which most definitely, you know, the allusion I'm making here is that those who had the money to be Masons also had the money to go serve in public office. So absolutely, right, it was a Masonic Republic. Stands to reason.
It was, well, the Masonic Republic idea can mean a number of different things. One, you know, it's sometimes used to argue that the American Republic was founded specifically on Masonic principles, and thus embodied those principles, as opposed to simply being a republic that was heavily influenced by Masonic ideas. See, that's there again is this thing that's impossible. It's what you can't see and what people don't say. is to what degree, and I would have an interesting question. I think there's a serious question that without the Masonic organization in the American colonies as to whether or not the revolution could have been successfully organized and carried out as it was. And I think the same thing is true for the French Revolution, that without things like the Nine Sisters Lodge and the Duke of Orleans and the way in which Freemasonry connected people together.
Absolutely.
As
people
to
of all
whether
classes,
or not the revolutions could have achieved their ends.
Means.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there were people that were politically involved, not politically involved in the revolution, as well as the Masons, things like that. As long as you had the means by which to pay the dues, you could be in. It didn't matter if you were somebody of high estate. Didn't matter if you were somebody. Of course, if you had more money, you could absolutely move up to the higher ranks a whole lot faster. And there are different, of course, depending on which branch of Masonry you're talking about, Scottish Rite or regular Rite. It's just the fact of how many degrees there are. To me, it really makes a lot of sense because, like you're saying, people from these groups went out, met privately after, and they were the ones that were the Sons of Liberty. They were the ones that were Nine Sisters Lodge outside of things that took on the storming of the Bastille in France, that kind of stuff. So the fact that these societies, like you said, have secrets, but aren't necessarily secret.
Now, the Sons of Liberty are an interesting case. Those are the guys that carried out the Boston Tea Party, you know, which was one of those things that kind of got the, you know, a kind of warm-up for the revolution.
Yeah.
The Sons of Liberty were, I'm not sure it has been a total head count, but they were all or mostly Freemasons. In fact, they belonged to a single lodge in Boston called St. Andrew's Lodge. I mean, that's where the Boston Tea Party, for all practical purposes, was plotted, if not in St. Andrew's Lodge, they were plotted by members of the lodge. But here's the interesting thing they did. So they're going to carry out this criminal act. But they don't want to carry out the criminal act as Freemasons, because if they did that, that would then besmirch the lodge and all other Freemasons.
Which of course, has its roots in England.
Yeah.
So you can't besmirch the lodge.
Every colonial Freemason took an oath of loyalty to the king.
Yeah.
And that was kind of important, because it meant that you became a rebel and you were a Freemason, you broke an oath that you had taken as a Freemason.
That's right. There were two treasons going on politically and culturally within your right.
So what they did is that they formed a spin-off secret society. So they go, look, we're not going to do this as Freemasons, so I tell you what, we'll become the Sons of Liberty. In other words, the Freemasons, who aren't a political secret society, but are a secret society based on the pursuit of fellowship and enlightenment, but the Sons of Liberty are a political secret society. So what you had were basically the same two groups of people doing different things under different names, but they're still the same group of people, and the Sons of Liberty would almost certainly have never come together in the way that it did unless they had first been in the lodge together. And that's how these things tend to constantly sort of combine with each other.
Yeah, precisely. They really do interweave themselves together, and it's interesting to see. One of the questions that we had from listeners whenever I put things out the other day was, how do these cabals keep their secret? And, of course, a lot of it comes in through ceremony, things like that. Gentlemen's oaths, really, is what it is, you know. But some of the gentlemen's oaths get a little severe. Let's just say, like the myth of Hiram Abiff that has gone into in the Masonic tradition, and of course the whole concept of giving somebody the third degree, and...
Well, the thing about secret oaths, I mean, you know, again, the basic reality is that people take secret oaths and then a lot of people break them. So, for instance, if you want to find out Masonic rituals, all you have to do is go down on the web and you can find them. All right? So they're really not all that totally secret. I mean, if you look for them, you can find them.
There's a whole National Geographic thing where they come into all of it. You know, even you can go out and I guarantee you at some half-price books, you're going to find a copy of the rituals of the Knights of Columbus. Like, guaranteed, it's there. It was in somebody's uncle's bedroom, you know?
People talk about it. So it's not so much, well, here's the thing. In Freemasonry, I don't know how it is in the Knights of Columbus, but in Freemasonry, in the initiations, the one thing that's very clear is, and it is made clear over and over and over and over again, is that if I betray any of the secrets of the order, I will die horribly.
Yes.
And there are these grisly descriptions. You know, I'll have my throat cut across. I'll have my heart torn out. I'll be tied on a stake at Tide and eaten by crabs.
Yeah, just so you know, folks, not the case in the Knights of Columbus.
Okay, all right. So you don't threaten them with horrible, painful death.
No. We threaten you with cooking catfish.
But I bet you're going to make them feel bad if they do that.
Absolutely. We're going to razz you hard.
This is. but the thing is, I mean, is someone who breaks the Masonic oath of secrecy? How many people have ever been taken out and had their throats cut? I suspect not that many.
Yeah.
All right. The importance, what that is meant to do is to reinforce the importance of secrecy. But yes, you are threatened with grisly, horrible death if you reveal the secrets. And while in the case of, you know, your average Masonic lodge, nobody's ever going to carry through on those threats. You know, they'll kick you out of the lodge and give you dirty looks, but they're probably not going to murder you.
Yeah.
Now, let's say it's the Mafia, a criminal secret society. What happens to you if you talk out of turn there? They kill you.
Yeah.
So, you see, it just depends upon how serious you... You know, it's like I said, you've got people who appear to be carrying out a black mass. Is this a joke or is it serious? You have societies that take an oath that says you never talk or you will die. In some of them, it's purely there for window dressing. In other ones, they mean exactly what they say. If you open your mouth, you're dead.
Yeah.
And you just kind of have to know your friends and know your audience to know what it is you're getting into.
Yeah, and there's even within the community of espionage, within the move, within the clandestine communities, things like that, those in and of themselves are secret societies. The business that they're in, just the four things that you lay out as far as what the hallmarks of a secret society are, they absolutely fit it. And that's what we have to remember, is that there are so many out there. It's hard not to get carried away, swept away, to go down fun rabbit holes. But we really do have to look at things through the lens of history, at least the known history that we have. You know, like you said, hey, there's bodies in Benjamin Franklin's basement. They look like they went through crazy things, by all modern forensics. What proof do we have? None. Other than that, it's just there. It's hard not to let the imagination run wild, but we also have to remember there is fact, there is fantasy. There is a difference between the two, a marked difference, and we have to learn to kind of temper ourselves when it comes to reading these things online. Because like you said, there is just a vast, as opposed to when you started in this field and just kind of came across it, there is a vast number of, because it wasn't like you could go online and just buy a copy of Albert Pike's work.
No.
You know, back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, it's the we live in the the information age. You know, you've got like the world's largest encyclopedia in the internet.
Yeah.
And I think it's very, very useful. But on the other hand, I mean, this is a question that people ask me. Maybe somebody is asking it here. You know, well, I go on and I look at all of these theories, which, you know, this is the question, you know, which ones are credible? Which one should I believe and which one should I ignore? And I get that question a lot from students when I tell them, okay, I want you to go out and research this and I want you to look at stuff. And they go, well, which one should I look at? I go, one, you're asking me to do your job for you. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You figure out. And so my advice to them, look at everything. All right.
Yeah.
Go out, I don't know, Google Freemasons, and then just look at all the stuff that comes up. And again, don't approach it from the idea that I have to believe this. Just take it in for what it is. The other thing you have to do is that, look, you can, if you just, you know, use a little bit of sense, you can figure out whether or not someone, you know, for instance, do they provide any kind of source material in terms of what they're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Do they mention any specific names or events, or are they just kind of, you know, literally ranting on about some sort of conspiracy by space crabs or something, and they provide no evidence for it? Common sense ought to tell you that one source is probably a, you know, not necessarily whether it's implicitly true and the other was an implicitly false, but that this one probably has more going for it than the other one. Still, look at them, because there may be, even in something that's, you know, pretty much BS, there might be some things that would be useful. Remember, it's this idea of looking for things that connect. You know, it's like a concept of connecting the dots. Well, first of all, you have to go around collecting the dots. So pick those up wherever you can. Be critical, be skeptical. I mean, be open-minded, but be skeptical of everything you're reading and don't believe it. Just take it in.
That's right. That's right. And it's so hard to agnostically look at information. Like I said earlier, just looking at it merely as a point of datum. That's it. You're adding it to a data set that is your opinion that is now going to be your more informed opinion, hopefully, through doing this and through following this process. And that's what I was trying to get across to our and Godspeed, former Dudes and Beer group member. Godspeed to you in your quest for capital T truth, as we put it on this show, because there's truth in the capital T truth. There's a universal truth that is there. There's fact. Here it is. So thank you so much for coming on this show, for taking the time to come on.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Well, I mean, seriously, this is... And I watch a lot of documentaries, Professor, a lot, a whole lot. And it's because, like, I'm willing to watch the documentary. I'm willing to hear somebody else's take on the information. And like I said pre-show, to hear you come at the information you come at, be it the Knights Templar, be it the Assassins, be it Sunni-Shiite split, things like that, to come at the information so dispassionately the way that you do, where it is like, look, here's just a point of fact. Let's look at it. Let's move on. It is by far one of the best lectures and lecture series that I have attended ever. It is really, really well informed. It gives you references out the wazoo that if you're like me and going to sit there and deep dive into things and kind of do your own bibliography with your tablet or your computer, which is what I do. I'll sit there, and as you make references that pop up on screen, I'll go and start reading them while you're talking, and just make that connection. And it really does lay out things in such a logical dispassionate point of view, like we try to put them on this show, where it's like, let's get beyond it. Like, the Zazz is cool, don't get me wrong. Like, hey, I want to do a whole adrenochrome episode, don't get me wrong, But the question is that there? Is that actively happening? Let's look at these things from an educated point of view, because you cannot lose track of that. And it's so easy to, in this fast information, chase a headline day and age.
Yeah, somebody once told me, again, I wish I could say who, but it was a long time ago, that the real answer to almost every question is maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of stuck with me. And I think you can be more certain in some cases, but yeah, it's, you know, we live in a strange and beautiful world. All right.
Yeah.
And we also live in this climate of, you know, there's always somebody trying to sell you something. There's somebody trying to steer you away. There's someone trying to steer you towards something. Keep your eyes open. Keep your ears open. Try to figure out what's real. You know, a skeleton in the basement is real. A turd on a plate is real, unfortunately.
It's there.
And then don't fall in love with any explanation. Just follow where the clues lead you and see how they assemble. Don't start forcing them together. Let the puzzle sort of reveal itself. Anyway, I'm really glad, you know, I thank you very much for all of the very, very kind things that you said. I'm very glad that, you know, that you enjoyed the Real History of Secret Societies. I hope there are other people out there who do as well. And yeah, I make money off of it, but you know,
well,
really not all that much.
But on the other hand, even if I'm a professor at a university too, not all that much, but you make money.
Yeah, you know, they pay me. You know, and where else do you get paid to pursue a hobby? All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, where else do you get paid? The one thing that, you know, people tend to think that university professors kind of live the life of Riley, which is, you know, really we do a lot of very kind of mundane, boring stuff, and we have to attend a lot of meetings and, you know, deal with university administrations, which is never fun.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it is one of those things where really, if you work it right and you have something that you're interested in, you get a chance to really work every day with things that you know and that you can learn at the same time. And again, the thing I go back to is that what's really kept me interested in this job, what kept me doing it for four decades, was that every day, literally, I would learn something new. There's this kind of gradual little enlightenment that comes with it. And even if in the end the enlightenment is just confusion, well, at least you know what's there as opposed to what isn't.
Yeah.
But it's been great being on, and hopefully I think we covered some interesting points. And
well, absolutely, and, we would love to have you back on to talk about Knights Templar, all kinds of fun stuff, because this whole series covers so many things. And it's really great to hear somebody talk about it, like I said, in an educated point of view, to really come at it from a lens of history, yet still dispassionately from a lens of history, and look at things for the facts that they are, and let's just see where they lead us. And thank you so much for taking the time. Please do hold the line. Tell everybody where they can go to, of course, your books are available on the Dudes and Beer store, but where else can they go to get your books? Where can they go to get the series, to sign up for great courses?
Well, see, I guess
the main
books I would pitch would be, you know, the you know, anybody who's interested in what I think is a very different take on Aleister Crowley, and I would add that I'm not a follower of Aleister Crowley any more than I'm a member of a secret society, but
he's
an interesting guy. Secret Agent 666, if you're interested in espionage and skullduggery in the early 20th century, Trust No One, The Secret World of Sidney Riley. And then probably the most recent book I've done, again, if you're interested in the Russian Revolution, politics, international finance and intrigue, that would be Wall Street and the Russian Revolution, 1905 to 1925. I think all of those are available, you know, through Amazon and any of the other sort of booksellers that are available. Working on some other projects, I might end up co-authoring a book that will deal with the rise of Hitler and connections with him. I've written other things. I have articles in academic journals, most of them espionage related, on a variety of spies. I also have topics and maybe more general interest, everything dealing from Basil Zaharoff, the, you know, merchant of death, one of the world's first billionaire arms traders. Again, things on the rise of Hitler, Ignatius Trebitsch Lincoln. You might want to look. There's a magazine called New Dawn, which is published in Australia. I've had a number of articles published in that, and those are pretty, you know, quick and to the point in terms of getting material. The Real History of Secret Societies is produced by The Great Courses. We had the cooperation of the History Channel and A&E Networks in the production and promotion of that, which meant that they get to vet all the scripts.
Yeah.
And so you can find that, you know, you can go online and just look at The Great Courses. They have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of wonderful courses on all sorts of things. I mean everything. So you might want to take some time to kind of explore that. Mine is there. I think you can also find it if you go to Amazon Prime.
That's where I found it.
Yeah, and you go down. See, I didn't know that until I was just hunting around one night for something to watch, and then I run across my own thing. So it's on there as well. You have to hunt. That blew my mind.
My
but anyway,
wife found it. My wife found it. Was like, oh yeah. By the way, you know, because like every once in a while, you know, beginning middle of the month, we know that things post to platforms. So
and
like,
you can
hey,
buy
look,
it in different
like,
formats. You can get it just audio. You can get the video. You can get DVDs.
I want to say
you can download it. You can buy individual episodes. You can get an entire written transcript. So if you want to read it, you can do that.
Absolutely. So, if you go to the website, you can get all kinds of stuff. I know on Amazon Prime, The Great Courses series was like $7.99 a month, something like that.
Yeah.
It was some insanely awesome price, and that's why I was like, heck yeah, I do it.
I own no stock in the company, but yes, they put out a good product and they have lots of stuff. So, you know, if you're there, you know, check out and what are the things they have as well and go from there.
Well, and thank you so much for taking the time to do that. Thank you so much once again for taking the time to be on the show this evening.
It's my pleasure.
Please do hold the line while we close things out here on our side. While you're online checking out all the great stuff by Professor Richard B. Spence from the University of Idaho, his books, all once again available on the Dudes and Beer store. Stop on by dudesandbeer.com. You can check out the Knowledge Vault. That's where we keep all kinds of great PDFs for guests like what we had last week with Mike Turber talking about declassified government programs, all kinds of fun things. I will be, I'm sure, finding some PDFs in regards to the information that we talked about this evening and adding them there as well. Make sure to stop on by HC Universal Network for all of our episodes. You can go to Dudes and Beer for them as well. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Remember, keep weaponizing your minds. We've been doing it here since 2015. Till next time, if you can't be good at it. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.